This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And it's been a while since we heard about the controversial Therme Spa at the center of the Ontario Place redevelopment. And remember, Mayor Olivia Chow backed off her opposition to it in exchange for a big bailout check from the province. Well, this week, the main group opposing that secret deal came out with some eye-popping numbers. They say taxpayers are on the hook for $1 billion, a billion with a B, compared to Therme's $450 million investment. But it's Therme that will be reaping all the profit. They want to know what is in it for taxpayers. Also this week, and we talked about this earlier in the week with the head of the Toronto Police Association, there's that scolding letter to police from regarding their handling of pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas protests. And it came from six city councillors, including two who serve on the Police Services Board. Well, the police are not happy about that, and that is to put it very mildly. They say they used necessary force and made arrests as the demonstrations grew more violent. And they wanted a show of support from the mayor. And the police union boss says she never even called them back, even though she promised to do so. And Olivia Chow has said she will not come out against that letter. And if you ask my opinion, I don't think that little tiff will be going away. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak, Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, and David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto. Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
David, let's begin with you. What do you make of the numbers unveiled by the group that opposes the Ontario Place redevelopment and the secret deal at the heart of it?
Well, I haven't had a chance to look at the figures that they're actually using. I haven't looked at them myself. But, of course, the whole deal at Ontario Place has been shrouded in a secrecy put on by the province, which allows any figures to be used. They have a 99-year lease they're looking at. The public has never seen it. And so, and there are many other examples I could use. So Ontario Place and the people who are looking after its good fortunes are deserving every kind of difficulty they can get because they're not being square with the public.
And David, what do you think of Olivia Chow having said she's going to back off her opposition?
Yeah, I don't think she quite went that far. She said she wasn't going to press a specific thing. I think she's probably indicated that it's a provincial matter, not a municipal matter, and therefore she's not going to press forward. But I think probably they left enough ground for other people on the council to carry the ball against what is happening in Ontario Place.
Alex, what do you make of all of that?
Sure. You know, as David said, it's a bad deal. It's a deal that's in secret, and that never works out well for taxpayers. I think that there's better use of the land there. I think that a spa could go just somewhere else. I think it's a good thing to have. I have no issue with it in itself. But it really should be in the name of the opposition group, Ontario Place for All, not a private company running some facility there. However, I do want to point out just, I think, a real hit to the credibility of this Ontario Place for All group, where their study talking about the cost and business feasibility of this spa pointed that Hotel X also has a spa. And this is just like a basic non-understanding of what type of spas we're talking about here, where the therm spa is a giant spa with pools and saunas and all that. Hotel X has like massages and probably a small sauna. Like, it's not the same thing. And I thought it was a very odd piece to put forward in their opposition. So,
Karen, what do you think? I mean, the Conservative government, the PC government, keeps getting in trouble with certain things. And then there's the whole secrecy piece that I think really annoys people.
Yeah, you know, it's a balance, for sure. And I don't know how this is going to play out because, you know, again, this group has brought forward its audits, but I don't, you know, how those were done and whether they are actually reflective of the real costs. Again, there's a question mark there for sure. And there's no question that this group is motivated by the fact they don't want the spa there. So they're not going to release anything that would say anything except that the spa shouldn't go there and it's going to cost taxpayers money. And this is a terrible insult to the people of Ontario and to Toronto in particular. So that is what it is. But you know, and again, we are also off the heels of getting burned for the soccer.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's for sure some heightened awareness about public officials negotiating on behalf of the taxpayer for big projects that end up just putting us on the hook. That is real too. But the other challenge the government has is when they're negotiating a business deal, it's not negotiated in public. It never is, and it shouldn't be, because there's many considerations that just and many deals that can't be done in public. But when it all breaks down, when the public loses faith that the government actually has their best interest at heart, and I think that may be where we're at right now, and that is a concern for the government that they need to address head on. In that if the public has lost the trust of the government to protect their interests, that's an issue.
Well, yeah, and it's a secret deal, but one of the key parts of it is that it's this incredibly lengthy lease, a 99-year lease, or is it a 95-year lease? I mean, who does that, and how is it that possibly going to be in taxpayers' best interests, Alex?
Sure. I mean, I imagine the length of the lease is to reflect the investment that the spa would have to make it worthwhile, that they can't just have their, you know, prices jacked up overnight. So there's obviously a reason for that. But at the same time, we need to be getting more back for it. And that's the real issue here. We're not getting anything in return except for the right to pay to go here, the option to pay to go here, right? I don't get what's in it. It's not going to create new jobs. Like, it's just taking up some public space.
Well, I guess the theory is that they're coming up with cash that the province doesn't have to come up with. But I don't know how that that's going over, David.
No, I don't. And I don't think it's clear to anybody. So I think from the beginning, this was an attempt to give private benefit to certain people at the public expense. And I think they're still trying to get away with it. So I think they should just reorganize themselves and start over. There's reasons and good reasons for spas around. They don't have to be at Ontario Place. The dream and opportunity for Ontario Place still remains, and it's not being satisfied by the current deal.
Karen, I mean, the thing we always hear is it's okay, and we heard this a lot having to do with those FIFA games. It's a bad deal, but we can't get out of it. Getting out of it is going to cause more cost and disruption than staying in it. You know, I think the public might be sick of hearing that.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, I don't think Ford should take that position that we're too far down to get out of it now. I think that if he really believes in the spa, which it appears that he does, then he needs to make the case for why it is a net benefit to Ontario Place. And whether he's done that or not, I think the verdict is still out, to be honest. And, you know, this group clearly has a position, and they're never going to be convinced, right? Like their only victory is that the spa not be built. But whether or not that's what the majority of people are feeling, that's not something I actually have a handle on.
Do you think that this will go away, Alex? I mean, the poll numbers for the Ford Conservatives went up a bit recently. I don't know if this is something people will vote on, but it's certainly, I think, hits right directly at their area of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not going to swing any votes. I mean, it's directly impacting people who are not voting PC anyway. It's in, you know, some liberal NDP ridings and catchment area for that. But yeah, it does play to this bigger issue, which is giving things away to private companies for the benefit of private companies and not for anybody else. And then secrecy layered on top of that, big dollar figures layered on top of that, it just starts to look bad. So if this is something that continues to drag them down, if that's another anchor around the PC government's neck, then they might start to find a way to get those anchors off, which they have done. They have walked things back. So it's not out of the question that they will back away from it if it starts to heat up in a bad way.
David, do you think any of this has to do with the fact that it's not a conservative riding at all where Ontario Place is?
No, I don't think that's a real factor. It may be a factor in some people, but I don't think it's a decisive one or even a significant one. No, I think it's got more to do with the way Alex put the issue. And I think those three things should bear in mind, on the mind of the government.
Okay, let's move along to that letter. So six city councillors signed an open letter to the police saying it was called Protecting the Right to Protest. They had heard from some of their constituents who were protesters, who accused police of using excessive force. Anybody watching video of those demonstrations would see that there was force used against police officers, and there were some arrests, and nobody is walking anything back, and it looks like it's a rift with the police and the police association, and particularly there's this issue of the two that are on the police services board, and I shouldn't say nobody's walking anything back. One of the councillors on the police services board, Lily Cheng, did walk it back, saying, I mean, this baffles me as an explanation, that she didn't have time to read it. Karen.
Sorry, I was going to say, there seems to be a lot of that in our politics these days.
Yes.
The prime minister can't read his thesis documents. Lily can't read a letter she's going to sign. But no, all joking aside, I actually think that this is a significant issue. And that the mayor brushed it off, I think, is I think it's appalling, because the reality is that these quote-unquote protests are becoming more aggressive, more intimidating, less about anyone's freedom of speech, and more about trying to intimidate people in neighborhoods and communities, particularly the Jewish community. And the fact that when these protesters, they don't carry a Canadian flag. In fact, they refer to Canada as so-called Canada. And why anybody, any elected official, would grant this group of intimidators any special attention is beyond me. And the police have been out diligently trying to keep public order in the face of this intimidation with no help from anybody. And our resources are being poured into keeping the streets safe. And all of our city, these six city councillors, have the gall to suggest that the police are at fault. I think it's shameful. And I think the fact that the mayor wrote, like, that little missive that she wrote, I think is appalling. And I absolutely, however Lily wants to do her dance around, sorry, I shouldn't have signed it. Okay, fine. Maybe she can get a pass, but it's not acceptable.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, that issue being, you know, aside, I'm not sure I want people on boards and city councillors who don't read the things they sign. Alex?
Yeah, well, I mean, I definitely agree that we don't want people who sitting on a council who don't read what they sign. But I do disagree with the bigger kind of argument here that, you know, people shouldn't be able to protest, right? And I think that's so fundamental to who we are as a country, is that people should be able to protest. And ultimately...
What do you mean? But they're able to protest. They take over the streets every weekend.
But what I guess the question is, where do we draw the line, right? And I mean, people should be able to protest. Is there...
But they are protesting. Right, who's stopping them?
Well, I mean, it sounds like it sounds like you want to stop them. It sounds like Karen wants to stop them. It does sound like there is there's at least a lot of constraints that people want to put in place to stop people. And additionally, I think this is being blown out of proportion probably by all sides here, because I spoke with somebody who was on the pro-Israel side of the rally this past weekend. It was at Nathan Phillips Square, right? And he said, you know, the counter-protest was, you know, nothing. Like, it didn't really sound like it was actually
right,
a big
that
deal.
That was at that particular one, but there are thousands of people,
sure.
And they're... I mean, nobody says they shouldn't protest. They just say they shouldn't protest illegally. They shouldn't block infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't intimidate older Jewish people. They shouldn't block hospitals, and they shouldn't assault police.
For sure. But I think we're conflating a small number of incidents with the bigger issue. And I think that also, just as a more principled, you know, way of looking at it, city councilors are allowed to say these things, and if you don't like it, then we can vote against them, right? Like that, it's that simple. I don't think there's any conflict with them sharing their opinion. That's what they're here to do. And then, frankly, I think the Toronto Police Association gets offended by kind of everything that happens, and they could also, you know, take a step back. We saw in the budget process they overreach a lot, and they don't need to, you know, clutch their pearls every time.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, the city councilors, they can say what they want. The issue was with the two who are on the police services board, and David, I mean, I think there's an issue if a mayor kind of gets a reputation for being anti-police. I'm not sure that's a place that she would really want to go. And there have been a number of other incidents where police do not feel like they're being supported by Olivia Chow.
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't get that first part. No, I think Alex is right. The thing is being blown out of proportion because everybody who's spoken on the matter seems to have their own self-interest at heart rather than the issue itself. First of all, the people have the right to demonstrate. Secondly, the police have a right and a responsibility to make sure that they do it according to the law and proper process. Thirdly, the people on the board have the right to speak out. That's why they're on the board. And four, it seems to me that the mayor is absolutely right. She has no business telling councillors what they can or cannot say. So I'm sorry. I think this is far being blown out of proportion because people have an axe to grind in all four quarters.
Right. But, you know, when public officials get a bit of a rap as not being supportive of police, do you think there's a danger that that is going to stick to Olivia Chow?
Only if people want to repeat it. I've known her over the years, watched her over the years. I don't get what they say that is true. I don't get that. And she's actually, she didn't take a line against the police. She talked about the people's right to speak. So I think that people want to make something out of it, and they're making a little bit out of it. And I hope it goes away because it doesn't help anybody. It sure as hell doesn't help the cops. It doesn't help the protesters. It doesn't help the people doing their job. It allows other people to have an axe to grind to have their light of day. Sure.
Okay, we'll see how it plays out. Moving up the highway to Vaughan. So the mayor of Vaughan came out trying to get rid of these extremely, I would say, disruptive last-minute kind of car rallies. Is that going to be effective? And how bothersome are these things, Karen?
Well, I don't know. I don't live in Vaughan, and so I can't speak to the disruption. But what I will say is that, you know, I disagree with David on some of what he previously said, but what we're seeing is that people think they have a right to do whatever they want to do it, wherever they want to do it, at any time they want to do it, irrespective of what conditions they're creating that might make the community unsafe. And then when you when you try to put some order around things, just to say, listen, we live in a community, which means there's give and take on both sides. You know, suddenly you're oppressing somebody, or, you know, you're preventing them from expressing the right to free speech or whatever. And at some point you're like, you know what? The way we live in harmony is by having a couple rules that we all agree to. And if this attempt to say, listen, you know, you can't have these car rallies because they're dangerous, they're noisy, someone's going to get hurt or killed. And if you want to do this, go to a track because infrastructure is there to support that, not parking malls or churches or streets that aren't busy. And so I think it's completely appropriate for the mayor to say, this is not acceptable. This is not the rules we're going to live by. And if you want to do this, then go find a safe place to do it that's built for that purpose.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl.
And if you want to do this, then...
Oh, Daryl, you've got to turn down your radio.
I'm going to take a call from...
Okay, I am going to let Daryl go. Daryl, you can call back, but your radio has to be off. That's a reminder to everyone. If you want to talk to us on air, your radio has to be off because there is a delay on it. You know, I have to agree with Karen that we're in a place where everybody thinks they can do exactly what they want, when they want, without necessarily regarding other people, Alex. I mean, and I think possibly these car rallies in the middle of the night are an example.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think we don't talk enough about, because it's such a normal part of our lives, just how dangerous cars are. I mean, cars are one of the leading ways that people die. The car rallies are just one aspect of it, but people drive recklessly and dangerously in the city all of the time, and there's not a lot of enforcement, not nearly enough of enforcement. The amount of times where I'll see somebody just speed past a stop sign and then zoom up to, you know, 60 kilometers an hour on a side street because they think they're going to save 30 seconds. It happens every day, and we do so little about it. So the car rally's a good place to crack down so much more. But at the same time, I think the penalties seemed quite low. I think it was, you know, $1,000, $2,000 fine, which, like, obviously is not nothing, but I don't know why we can't be a little bit more punitive when we see people doing something illegal.
Well, don't they get points? I mean, they're really going to get hit when they try to get insurance if there are points involved.
My understanding was, because this is not for the actual stunt driving, this was just for the get-together. So, yes, if you get caught doing the stunt driving, that's a different thing, but this was just if you're at one of these rallies that aren't organized, you get these fines.
David, what's your take on this?
No, I think actually both Karen and Alex have it right. They're disturbing the public peace is an important part of people's life to be able to depend on it. And so it seems to me that having the rallies that they're talking about and having it without care about the public and indeed perhaps offending some laws, I think that it's wrong. So there we are.
Okay, well, some people say those protests follow the same kind of a script. Let's take a call from Stan in Mississauga. Hello, Stan.
Hello, Emmy. Thanks for taking my call. It's certainly an interesting topic. Sometimes I feel the police can't win. They're either too strong or not strong enough. But I think the bottom line is, they do have a responsibility to enforce the law. And I don't think senior Jewish people or anybody should be intimidated by any of these protests. And, you know, it almost certainly what's happening in Palestine is terrible. There's no doubt about it. But almost some feeling that we're bringing problems of the world to our country. And that offends me as a Canadian. I mean, my parents were immigrants and they came for a better way of life. But this is, like you say, it's almost like the protesters are trying to make it bigger and better. And I feel for the police, but some issues have to be addressed. It has to be enforced. The law has to be enforced. And you know, when we spend $15 and $18 million, they're saying, on the police services for this, I think
12 a month. Yeah.
Sorry.
The number was 12.
Oh, 12. Okay, but there's no doubt it's growing. It's hard on the police, and I support the police. I think it always should be enforced, just like with the street racing. I mean, that's why we have the law, and that's why the law-abiding citizens expect.
Okay, thanks for that. I'm We're going to take a call from Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl. I hope your radio is turned down.
I had to turn it on before because you guys were breaking up. I couldn't hear anything. So anyway, regarding, you know, these protests, I think if, you know, the police went very, very easy in the city on it at the very beginning, and I don't think they should have. They should have, you know, set some kind of standards there. And I think these basically, these are going to turn into riots. If the police are doing their job properly and making these things responsible, you're going to find that these people are there not to simply protest. They're bringing their agenda here. A month or so ago, let me mention, you know, people come to Canada for a better life. And I think from these protests that I'm seeing, these people haven't come here to enjoy the wonderful diversity of our city.
Okay, Daryl, thanks for that. I'm looking at the clock. We're getting close to wrapping up. Of course, we're getting a federal budget on Tuesday. I don't think there's going to be much in the way of surprises. There's a roadshow announcing billions and billions of this and that. But let's give everyone 20 seconds to say what they're hoping for the city that doesn't get all mired up in jurisdictional issues. Karen.
Yeah, if they could really, you know, break through some of the housing stalemate and, you know, figure out how to cut that red tape and get that federal infrastructure money to support what the City of Toronto needs to support the growth that it needs to manage, then I think that would be a win for Toronto.
Alex.
I think the feds are so out of touch right now that I'm really not optimistic about anything. But I do agree with Karen that they should use, you know, housing dollars to try to extract some compromises from the city and the province on zoning to allow for that money to be spent wisely.
And David, last 20 seconds to you.
Yeah, I think the federal government is on the right track with respect to housing, but they're on the wrong track, or they're not on a helpful track by simply saying, here it is, take it or leave it. Anytime any government says, I'm going to do such and so, I would say to them, who and where are your partners? If they don't have the partners, then they're just taking in the air.
Yeah, I think they have a tendency to do that. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, David Crombie, Karen Stintz, and Alex Blumenstein. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Dad.
Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, well, yes. Did you hear the Prime Minister's testimony before the foreign meddling inquiry yesterday? A lot of interesting things from there, and we'll talk about it when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Yesterday, we finally heard from the Prime Minister in his much-anticipated testimony at the public inquiry into foreign meddling in the 2019 and 2021 elections. And there were a couple of very interesting things there. He discounted the effectiveness of the Chinese election interference, and he questioned the reliability of Canada's spy agency's intelligence. And at the same time, he admitted that he didn't actually read the reports, but he relied on oral briefings. What do you think of that? So, the numbers, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Bob Richardson, Senior Counselor for National Public Relations, and Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting and a former CSIS analyst. Thanks for joining us. Hi.
Hi, Libby. Good afternoon, Libby.
Good afternoon. Well, let's begin with Phil. I mean, in our previous segment, we were talking about people not reading things they sign, and it seems mystifying that he would, you know, discount intelligence that he didn't even read properly.
Yeah, I think as a former CSIS analyst, Libby, my first reaction is one of extreme disappointment that all the work that went into these assessments by my former colleagues looking into Chinese foreign interference was ignored, discounted, not trusted, listed as unreliable. You know, and the people that work in this business, they do their best to get the best intelligence to the officials that need it. We don't pretend it's the end all and the be all, and we caution. You know, the information may be of certain reliability, but for this complete dismissal, and a lot of people I've been reading are saying that, no, he's throwing Jesus under the bus. That's exactly what he's done, and I'm just disappointed as a former analyst, and I feel for my former colleagues and what that means for their morale going forward.
Bob, yes, he has thrown CSIS under the bus, but certainly he hasn't done the work himself. I mean, based on what, and what do you think of him doing that?
Yeah, I think that's a ridiculous analysis, because if you listen to the whole thing, and I did watch a lot of the testimony yesterday, first of all, he was getting briefed by the clerk of the Privy Council, his national security advisor, by his chief of staff and others on this issue. It's not like he wasn't reading the thing, threw it off of his desk and put it in a garbage can. So let's make that point clear right off the top. He was engaged on the issue. On this issue, this sort of, and we can get into the specifics of it, this sort of stuff has been going on for 30 years or so. It's been going on during the life of his government. It went on under the life of the previous Harper government, et cetera, back. It has gotten worse in the last couple of years, and I believe Canada should act more aggressively now than it has. But prime minister after prime minister has discounted a lot of this sort of stuff because it just hasn't met the threshold of impacting our elections and also impacting our relationships with Beijing. That's the truth of the matter. Nobody likes to say it, but that's the equation that they look at when they consider these various incidents.
Let's look at that question of meeting the threshold, Phil. So in the case of Han Dong, now he is the MP that's now sitting as an independent because of these allegations that he was in league or influenced by the Chinese. So in the nomination meeting, there were voters bust in some question about whether they were organized by the Chinese government. And the prime minister said, hey, that didn't meet the threshold required to get rid of his nomination. What do you make of that, Phil?
Well, first to your previous commentator, I mean, he's in charge now. He's holding the ball. What Harper did or not did do is irrelevant at this point. The second point is that, you know, intelligence is there for a reason to make better decisions. And the fact that it wasn't, because it was inconvenient, is not an excuse to me. And, I mean, what do you want CSIS to say? We've shown demonstrably that a foreign power, not an ally of Canada, try to affect our elections. Whether or not they did is a moot point, and I still don't understand why people are saying there was no effect in the elections, because we don't know why people voted or who they voted for. I mean, what more do you want your intelligence service to do? No, it's not evidence, but it doesn't have to be evidence to take action. CSIS doesn't collect evidence, it collects intelligence. And if you're not going to at least read it and consider it and work it into your decision-making, you might as well put a for sale sign in the building, Libby, because the people that work there are, you know, wasting their time if their efforts are not being considered.
Bob, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, well, I disagree with Phil on this one. First of all, he did consider it, and he rejected it because he didn't feel that there was adequate evidence to take the step of disqualifying Han Dong in the nomination processes. For those of us who actually have been involved in nominations and have actually been in the ring, let me tell you, they're messy affairs. They're complicated, they're convoluted, and they're messy. They're a messy affair. So could there have been some activities that didn't quite make the cut? Possibly that could have happened. Did it affect the outcome of the election? Apparently not. So, you know, it's one of these ones where It's one thing to be an official from the ivory tower looking at this and saying, you should do this and you should do that. It's another person to actually be in the ring on the ground in a nomination and know that, and know what the situation is.
I mean, one of the things that I read as an explanation is, well, there are often people bust into nomination meetings. And Phil, I also was reading that Han Dong was told that there were questions about his conduct. He was kind of tipped off to it.
I've heard that as well, and I don't know the veracity of that, but that is the point of a busting. And yeah, I'm sure it does happen, but bust in at the cost of the People's Republic of China, which, as I said before, is not an ally of Canada, wanted to affect the elections. Whether it did or not is irrelevant. The fact is that they tried. They wanted a liberal minority government because they felt it was better suited to their interests. The mere fact that China tried this and is being completely ignored, that's the crux to me here. It's not whether a riding fell to person A versus person B. It's that we've had, and I agree, successive governments have ignored solid intelligence as this is happening. And that's the most egregious part for me, is that Canadians deserve to know that their elections are not being interfered with by foreign powers. And what I've seen and read the last couple of days gives me no assurances that the next election is going to be any better because the government doesn't seem to understand the importance of this issue.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Sheila in Mississauga. Hello, Sheila.
Hello, it's a stormy day, so I'm going to turn that out now. Justin, his background, his schooling is in acting. He was in, he took the course in whatever acting classes, or he was an acting teacher. So the clan that he has right now is all actors playing their role, okay? He never heeds anything. When the COVID came, he was the last one to react towards closing the airport and whatever. In every instant, he's the last one to take steps. So he watches the whole world, all the leaders, what they are doing. Then he follows up. Follow the leader then. That's it.
Okay. Not a fan of Justin Trudeau. I'm not sure how that relevant that is to this conversation. But where does this leave us, Bob, this type of testimony? I mean, is this going to shut it all down?
Well, this is probably where Phil and I will agree. I think this sort of conduct by the Chinese has been on the rise. And I think that is a fair comment to make. And it has been getting more explicit than it has been in the past. I think it does meet the threshold now where the government has to be more active. And this government needs to get more active on it and quite frankly, work with the opposition. This shouldn't be a partisan issue. We need to make sure our elections are free and fair and meet that threshold where people feel that it was conducted in an appropriate fashion. And if we have to take some measures now, if we have to spend some money to ensure the safety and security of our elections, we ought to be doing that. This whole process has notified us that it's been a problem, and it's been a growing problem, and we need to deal with it now.
Phil, before I ask you what you think will happen in terms of dealing with this, back to Han Dong. He's still sitting as an independent. The Liberals still aren't taking him back. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a great question. You have to ask the Liberal Party that, I suppose, Libby. I mean, is it more of an embarrassment issue that these allegations have been flying around for quite some time and they feel he's not an asset to the party because he's tainted? I really have no idea. I'm not a politician, but it sounds to me that there's some issues with him that make the Liberals rather reluctant to bring him back into the party.
Okay, well, and what do you think happens? Do you think the government will finally be taking this issue in hand?
No, I don't. And I agree with Bob. I mean, you know, it's just not a partisan issue. These are our elections. We are a democracy. And when you go to the polls, you should, you know, go there with the confidence that your vote will count, you know, and that other people's votes will count fairly, and they won't be coerced into voting a certain way. But no, this has been going on for 20, 30 years. governments of both sides of the House have not taken it seriously. As I said, we're under a Liberal government right now. If we get a change of government in the next fall, will the other government take it seriously? I hope so. But our track record is not very stellar in this regard, Libby.
Uh-huh. And, you know, if Donald Trump gets in south of the border, I mean, their take on what happened with the elections there, I don't know what the impact would be, but it certainly would get into the conversation here, I think, Bob.
Yeah, look, we have increasing in kind of incursions or difficulties from the state of India. We have problems from China. We have problems from Russia. And I'm sure there are other rogue states on these sort of issues, too, as well. We need to up our game. We need to deal with this in a nonpartisan fashion. And we need to spend money to make sure that our elections are safe and meet the qualification of being free and fair.
Okay. On that note, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Bob Richardson.
Thanks,
and Phil Gursky. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby.
Okay, bye-bye. We are going to take another break, and when we come back, the latest on what's going on with the Israel-Hamas war.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. There is no ceasefire in sight in the Israel-Hamas war now that Hamas has rejected the last few proposals. But the pressure on the Netanyahu government is growing, both internally. We saw the largest anti-government protests so far last weekend, and also from the U.S. President Joe Biden offered one of his sharpest rebukes of Israel's handling of the war, describing Netanyahu's approach to the conflict as a mistake and calling for a halt to the fighting. Now, for his take, I spoke to Dr. Amos Giora, who is a professor of law at the University of Utah and a former legal advisor to the IDF in Gaza. Amos Giora, thanks so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So, after this terrible incident where the aid workers were killed, two officers were dismissed and three others, I believe, reprimanded. Does it end there or will there be more consequences?
I think with respect to the specific event, the what you call a dismissal, what in Israel is being defined as firing of the two officers and the reprimanding of the others, including the general who's in charge of the Southern Command. I think for the specific event, I assume that's the end. That will be the end of it. That said, it's clear that the world, and I assume particularly President Biden, because he's the most important figure here, I'm not sure to what extent he's satisfied with that. And the question then will there be a fuller report? Yes, no, but I think in the immediate, your question, this is, I think, the most up-to-date response that the IDF will give. I assume it will be looped into the much broader, larger discussions, commissions of inquiry and so on, when this is all over. But for now, I think that this is where this particular incident, the investigation of it internally, will end.
What about a court-martial? No court-martial?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There's been back and forth over the course of the past years about court-martialing for operational decision-making. And we've gone back and forth on that. And as well, will somebody here be court-martialed? I don't know. Why don't you dismiss them? I'm not quite sure why you would court-martial. I'm not saying it's not possible. The three who've been reprimanded, they've been reprimanded. And I think the idea is not to court-martial. But again, I think in many ways, we're going to have to wait and see how so many different questions will be addressed when the war is over. But for now, this thing is still ongoing. I don't foresee anything more happening in the immediate.
Well, I mean, frankly, being dismissed from a deadly war doesn't seem like such a bad outcome.
For a major in the IDF, it's a career ender. consequences for him. I mean, I'm not comparing the firing of a major with the killing of seven individuals, but from his perspective, I think as a general, I think as a guy, you know, it's the end of his IDF career. In many ways, that's more significant. Maybe, I mean, we could have a long discussion about that. Is that more significant than a court martial? Even if he were to be court martialed, I can't imagine that he would be incarcerated. So from his perspective, his dismissal is just that. It's it's the end of his IDF career. But again, I think from the international perspective, will that satisfy? I'm not convinced.
One thing we've been hearing about is a big disconnect between the brass in Tel Aviv and the people on the ground, because the charge is that they ignored procedures. And the reports that we've heard is that there was a thought that there were armed Hamas operatives in that convoy.
Right. So when targeted killing decisions are made, the whole point is to identify someone who's a legitimate. It's a two-step process. One is identifying who's a legitimate target, and then defining when is that person a legitimate target. So it's not enough to say who is, but also there's a question of the when. From what one can understand here, there was intelligence information that whichever Hamas guy had been defined as a legitimate target was a legitimate target. And the intelligence said, well, he's now in this, I think it was a white car. But there too, it's not enough to say Hamas guy in white car. You have to be obviously incredibly careful to ensure that this is this guy in this car. And it's not a different car with a different set of people. There's no doubt to your question that clearly this was a mistake. There's no doubt about that. But to suggest that this was deliberate is beyond obscene. Was there a terrible operational decision here? Mistake? Yes, absolutely. Deliberate? No, of course not. But does it reinforce the need to exercise extraordinary caution in the implementation of intelligence information? Absolutely, yes.
The IDF has withdrawn a large number of forces from the south. Do you see that as a response to the demands from the U.S.?
100%. I see it. I think there are three answers. One, the so-called come to Jesus conversation that Biden had with Bibi. Two, I think there's realization that there's no victory here. I mean, Netanyahu keeps talking about together we will win and victory, victory, victory. There is no victory here. I think that there's increasing opposition in Israel to all this. I mean, look at the numbers of people who are participating in the rallies, and also listen carefully to the reservists, who I think are articulating the sense of, like, what the hell is this? What the hell are we all doing? Particularly when there's discussion about an additional roundup of a call-up of reservists. And it's an open question whether or not reservists will go, particularly when we're stuck in this political battle with the Orthodox, who refuse under any condition to recognize that they are actually citizens of the state of Israel and, have a duty to the state. And I think the more that this goes on, the more the public will say, as we say in Hebrew, dayenu, enough is enough. And I think that Netanyahu clearly understands that, while he's also seeking to avoid, going to jail with his own criminal trial underway in Jerusalem.
Couple of things there. Last week, I was talking to some other Israeli observers, and they were saying they don't think that the whole situation with striking down the draft exemptions for the ultra-Orthodox, they don't think that that will lead to a fall of the government. Do you agree?
It's a really good question. I mean, one of the questions is, to what extent will Gantz, Benny Gantz, who has joined the war cabinet for reasons that only he knows, and on the defense minister Gallant, in parentheses, full disclosure, I was his legal advisor, to what extent they will place pressure on Netanyahu. I think it's close in terms of, will that lead to the fall of the government? Two Jews, three opinions, two Jews, three synagogues. I go back and forth on that one, but I think it has highlighted the absolute unconscionable disparity between who has a sense of obligation to the state and who does not. And the fact also, frankly, that there's clearly an economic downturn in Israel. I mean, look at the ratings, and the fact that we, working Israelis, support endlessly those who don't do anything on behalf of the state. At some point, that will, in a political sense, will explode.
Well, yeah, it's been going on for decades, the resentment of the secular people who support the ultra-Orthodox.
The resentment has been exacerbated. You're 100% right. But the resentment has been exacerbated by the fact that the Orthodox simply refuse to recognize, acknowledge that they owe any duty to the state. And two, the fact that we have, what is it, 300,000 reservists who were called up. And the economic burden of the reservists is overwhelming. And if we're paying for the Orthodox. So you are right. This has been a decades-long fight. I think that it has now been exacerbated because of the past half year.
Meantime, the U.S. Told Israel there's a big threat of retaliation from Iran for the bombing of that embassy, consulate, whatever it was, in Syria that killed some very senior military people. So is there preparation for that? What's happening with that?
A possible Iranian response? I have to tell you that I've never totally bought into what Netanyahu tried to do, you know, drawing the famous red line of the UN with about Iran. I've never really viewed the Iran threat as something that, and the large things that keep me up at night, that is not one of them.
Okay. Anything else you want to leave us with? You mentioned the demonstrations are getting bigger and bigger.
But I tell you what happened. It's last, not this past Saturday, not 2 days ago, but 9 days ago, many of the hostage families joined the anti-government demonstrators. That's a significant step because they realize Netanyahu has been lying to them. Simple, full stop. Hostage families are in a bind. They need the government. And for them to cross the street to join the anti-government demonstrators is huge step for them. Obviously, not all the hostage families have done so, obviously. But for those who cross this side of the street to that side of the street, while they need the government to conduct the negotiations, if Netanyahu is conducting it in good faith, we could have a long conversation about that also, was a major step. And there was a clear sense of real anger at the demonstrations in the past week.
Okay. Amos Giora, thank you so much for that.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, and this morning we also learned that O.J. Simpson has died of cancer at the age of 76. Of course, he became famous as a football player. He made a fortune as an All-American in movies, TV, and advertising, and he was accused and acquitted of killing his former wife. I can still remember that famous police chase in that white Bronco when the murders came up. The murders were of his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman. And he was acquitted of that. The trial really highlighted the differences and different views of everything between the black and the white communities in America. And of course, we will have a lot more on that. Tomorrow is Free for All Friday. That's the day that we talk about what you want to talk about. So give us a shout then, especially if you could not get through during the week. And that's all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.